Len Roberts, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Let's go on.
Okay. You know, I wasn't sure I was going to read this poem. It's a short one, but it's a light poem. And I'm not sure it has that moment that we've been talking about, that, but it's a happy poem. One day, when Nancy was pregnant with Josh, we were up in Cape Cod vacationing. I looked out the window, and she was naked in the sand dunes. I mean, we had some privacy. She wasn't just on the beach, but she had the big belly, and she's just leaping up and down in the sand. I thought, well, I've got to write a poem about that. So here's a light one. It's called "Pregnant, She Dances." The storm had stopped, leaving the ocean calm. The roses dripping near where you stripped off the white blouse and white shorts to stand completely white in the knee-high grass. Arms held over your head, you danced, beneath oranges, beneath clouds. Not knowing, I watched from the window, your feet kicking sand ankle high, your pregnant belly floating out, stretching your skin like a bubble in batter, the roundness of it rising and rising, as though each leap created the child more fully, as though each sudden escape from the earth gave it more life.
When you write a poem, who do you write that poem to?
I never have anyone in mind. Like, as I said earlier, you know, I start with an image or a line, but as a poem starts working its way out of my gut, I realize that I am focusing on one person.
Who?
Well, it's Nancy, or it's Joshua, or it's lovely Lorraine, or it's, you know, I've talked to Dee Snodgrass a lot about this, because, you know, supposedly he began the confessional movement and all that, but when we talk about, well, is my poetry confessional because it's speaking with an I, you know, from the first person? And I don't believe it is, because my poems may start with a first person, I'm watching, but the poems are completely about the he or the she. They're out there. And that, to me, is what makes them objective, not subjective.
Oh, yes. Your point of view is what makes them focused and gives us clarity.
Right. So the emphasis isn't on my heart, isn't on my sorrow.
It's what you see.
Right. And the emotion that I bear toward this person and the emotion that this person creates in the world, which, to me, is the gift.
That is.
I think.
That is a good explanation. Billy Collins says he always imagines a reader across the breakfast table as he's writing.
He does.
Yes.
And he speaks to the reader.
Yes,
now,
he does.
I can't do that. I've tried writing poems with the second person, you, the reader. He's wonderful at it. I can write to one person, but I can't write to the reader. Billy, he does.
Here's something interesting. You and I both write about family a lot.
Yes.
And many contemporary writers do. I was reading recently that only since World War II is this kind of poetry prevalent. No one, and you studied the Romantic era.
Yes.
We never had Milton talking about his grandmother. We never had Tennyson. We never had any of the Romantics. Mm-hmm. So this is truly a modern phenomenon. And I think it's linked to the fact that as we evolve, we value and cherish more than we did. I mean, after all, in the 16th century, children were little adults, in the 17th century and the 18th century. And really, modern times is more about valuing.
That and the fact, I think, that we've been given permission. In reading poetry, you know, poetry usually has its boundaries. It usually has its traditions. I think Wordsworth was the first poet to give us permission to write from this I, from the person. You know, when he writes about his childhood, when he writes about going off into nature and becoming one with nature. I think he started to give us permission. And I think in the 20th century, the great adventuresome poets, such as Robert Lowell. I mean, when people want to criticize Lowell, they'll say he's a confessional poet. You read his poetry. And he makes, this is the point, I think. I think we've been given permission. And in the 20th century, you're absolutely right. I think we are without values, and so we're trying to establish values on a more personal level. I think when most things lose meaning, then you're thrown back on the self. And the self then has to throw out its own filaments, as Whitman says. And some of my filaments are my family and how I relate to them, or my loved ones and how I really relate to them. So the self then makes its own meaning. I think that when I write a poem about the I in relationship to my wife, it's very personal, but the more personal it becomes, the more universal it becomes.
Always,
because
yeah.
I just assume that everyone who's out there listening has someone that they love.
You have to assume that.
Yes. I mean, we're all part of a human community, and when I write from the humanness within me, Galway Kinnell said that at one conference. I overheard him say that the more personal your poem becomes, the more universal it can become.
But across the board, everything that we know as writers, we have to know that everybody else reading it knows as much as we do. I mean, you have to have faith that everyone has felt what you felt,
yes,
knows as much, or else why, you know, why bother? We're
yes,
not in a silver cocoon.
But that is a wonderful feeling, too, because that means that we are in a brotherhood and sisterhood, that we are all one.
Maybe we are, but you know, there are a lot of people out there that are causing mischief in the human spirit. And I think at this time in history, I believe the poet and the poem is more important than ever before, because I feel we have to hold on to something that can remain permanent, and that is the voice. Everything else seems to be in, there are worms in your computer, and there are bombs on the airplane,
and there is fear
in the subway.
It's chaos.
But if in that chaos, if the voice is like a silver thread that goes from one of us to the other.
Well, you know what, Frost, again, I love, you know, Frost did not write much criticism, but what he wrote, I mean, he's so concise. What he says is that the poem is a momentary stay against confusion.
Perfect.
And, you know, it is. It's like, or what Eliot says in The Wasteland, shall I at least shore my rune, shore up these fragments against my ruin. And I think that's what we're doing. We're taking something and we're saying this is a permanent value. This poem stops time. It stops the chaos. This is what we can go back to.
Len Roberts, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and I would not want to be anywhere else.
Okay. Now, this is a first kiss poem. When I first started writing, I didn't know you couldn't write about first kisses. So I wrote this as an exercise and sent it off, and it won a little contest.
What was the little contest?
The Randall Jarrell Poetry
Ooh,
Prize.
Ooh, that's no little.
Yeah, it was nice. It was, and I was just beginning, so it's a short, simplistic poem, but I like it. It's called First Kiss. When that blue-black cloud came over the sandlot with raindrops big as marbles, we ran down the storm-white alley into Big John's orchard, where we leaned, then clutched the other shivering body, and I had my first kiss. But what I remember most is the running, how the wet clothes hung to our skin, how those clouds billowed up and lightning struck the hill, and the smell of cut grass getting wet, the sense of chill coming, the wanting to go home and the wanting never to leave, the two of us who barely liked each other, breathing, holding hands, the way we'd hold an apple slick with rain, or a slingshot stone about to explode, about to soar away.
So significant a moment.
I remember it as clearly as breakfast this morning, more clearly. I mean, those clouds came, it was one of those summer thunderstorm days, the blue-black clouds came and raindrops, and truly, I mean, I remember all of that. Much more than I remember the kiss.
But if you can get back there, that's the safest place there is. And I believe for writers, whether it's in a crawl space under the steps or in your bedroom or in the treehouse, if you can literally get back there, you know, it is a place without stress.
You know.
Because time is stress. If you can get out of time, and I think every writer can really go back and smell that smell.
You
feel
know,
that way. It is so true.
It is true. It is. It's just amazing. Well, you know, Proust starts off with the smell of what is it, Madeleine and tea. It starts the entire novel. Remembers the things past. This is a little aside, but Carl Jung, the great 20th century psychologist, disciple of Freud, he's got this great theory that You know, when we come in our daily lives, we come across a series of many crises, right? And one of the things he says that we do automatically is that consciously or unconsciously, we go back to moments in the past that have crystallized.
If we are lucky.
You're right, exactly. And I think artists do it more than regular people because that's what we do. We try to go back to those moments. We try to understand them. But by going back to those moments, it gives us that security, that strength, so we can come back up to the present and deal with the mini crisis or the major crisis. And I find that, I think that's what I do quite often in my poems.
And we want to hear some more of those.
Yeah, let me read a poem that's current. I'm 56, and my wife is younger than me. I'm not going there. She's younger than I am, but she's getting older also. And of course, one of the things that you think of as you grow older and you start getting some illnesses here or there is mortality. And this poem is about that. It uses one line from Matthew's Gospel. It's a beautiful line. Matthew said, "The lamp of the body is the eye." You know, and the idea of the light coming from the eye struck me, so when I wrote this poem, I used it. It's called April Dusk, and it's for Nancy. Dull pewter light on the pond, fringed with the green shadows of trees across the road. The sky, one big pewter cloud, it's hard to look straight into. All that glare that says there's more light up there than we can bear. Which makes me remember Matthew's, "The lamp of the body is the eye." Even as I feel my eyes burning, spring allergies I had thought, the pollen and dust, the long days of sun holding on, 1 minute more than another until it's 8 o'clock. My wife and I still out on the patio with a little talk as the darkness filters in, taking the spruce and the fir and the hemlock, then the barn, then part of her face turned up toward the hill, then her shoulder, her arm, my leg, my foot, bit by bit, until we're nothing but voices. And most of the time, not even that.
Lynn Roberts, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. I love the cubism.
You know, I was just sitting there, and the darkness came, and it took the trees in the shadow, and it took the barn in the shadows, and it started taking her. And then it started taking me, and I thought, that's how it is.
How did you remember Matthew?
I don't know.
I don't either.
I don't
because
know.
You are such a renegade. You claim that you are a secularist. That's what you claim. But
yeah,
I claim that you are deeply religious and spiritual being. We know you're spiritual, but and I just think all of those hundreds of years of Catholicism are in your veins. I heard you do a marvelous lecture, Struggling with God, I think it was called,
yes,
or Fighting
yes.
with God, or
Struggling.
Arguing, all three things you do. And it was a disclaimer which was full of complete holiness. It was just a very holy lecture.
This poem, okay, a little background. I didn't speak until I was 4 or 5. And when I did finally start speaking, I had a terrible lisp. So when I got to elementary school, this one teacher took me aside for 3 years, the first 3 years of elementary school, and I had to, upstate New York, I had to go to school an hour early each day. And she would put marbles in my mouth and put me on the auditorium stage and have me read from the children's Bible for an hour, for 3 years, every morning, until I could say the words distinctly. And she, of course, I'd still have a lisp if it wasn't for her. Now when I get tired, I still lisp, but this poem is for her. It's called Correcting the Lisp. With 4 marbles in my mouth, I began with thou shalt not, reading for 3 years the 10 Commandments until I got the words perfect. The wish of W, the K of K. Sister Ann Zita standing for the daily hour in the auditorium's dark, listening to a lisp so bad she could not understand a word I said. The belt, a mumble, the pad held before my face. Boy looking up at a smile to my right, a frown to my left, masks I'd learn later in life that people put on during plays. Father mask of rage, mother mask of blood. My lips forming beneath the repeating mask for the black-winged nun who clicked beads and murmured prayers while I went on and on. Thou shalt not, teaching me sin, teaching me how to say it. It's a dark poem she did.
Why, though, is it a dark poem? I mean, look what she did every day. Look how tortured you were. I mean, it must have been, you must have hated getting up on that stage every day.
I'm amazed I didn't choke to death.
Well, actually, when you think of it, I never thought of that.
Imagine.
Marbles in your mouth.
Yes.
Oh, gee.
I mean, she could. In these days of legal pursuit, she'd never be able to do that.
But it worked.
It did work. And I never knew that until later.
Everyone in your life, Len, has been assisting you. Everything brought into your life has furthered you one more inch. Now, how do you explain that?
Angels.
Matthew.
D.H. Lawrence. D.H. Lawrence says, great short little poem. Someone's knocking on the door. Knocking on the door. It's the three angels. Let them in. Let them in. Isn't that a great line? I mean, that's... Yeah, I've been blessed.
Says it all.
I've been blessed.
How do you get teachers to want to do this from their deepest selves? I mean, I had a student 35 years ago who didn't show up for a tutorial at Antioch College where I was teaching, and he came to my door this week. He said, I came for my tutorial 35 years later.
Well, you know, as an established and wonderfully known teacher yourself, Grace, that you can't really teach anybody anything. You can show them ways to get what they want to learn. You can help them along the way. You can drop guidelines, but they do the work themselves. So what I try to do, and most of the time it doesn't work, but what I try to do, I believe that memory is the muse. Memory is the mother of poetry. So one of the first exercises I do with teachers when I'm teaching them writing workshops, so I asked them to go back to memory that stayed with them for a number of years. And then, and going back to Carl Jung, he calls it clustering, you know. If you get one good memory, then it will have a series of images, and you bring up those images. And the only reason the memory stayed with you is because it's somehow significant. And I believe, and I may very well be wrong, but I believe that if you bring up the right memory with the right images, then that will give you the rhythmical energy for the poem. In other words, music is not abstract. The rhythm of the poem is not abstract. I believe that it comes from the emotional core of the poem. And if it's an angry memory, that poem's rhythm is going to have that rolling tide, that wave motion. Now, again, it could be, and if it's a quiet memory, it's going to have the serenity. But anyway, what I try to do is help people to get in writing workshops to what they really want to write about, and then show them how to bring up their images. Once they have their images, try to find one line and let them go.
And the teachers then convey that. You think they take that into the class?
I've had some really nice successes with teachers who. You know, we all have. You're a wonderful teacher, Michael Glazer. There's so many people out there trying to do this. And I've had teachers write and say, I've used your exercise with 20 students, and it's worked. And then they've used it with 20 students, and it's worked. And it just, God knows where that ends.
You feel good?
I feel really good. Mm-hmm. Feel really. You do
is
too,
that
right?
Is that your specialty? I mean, yes. It's surely refuels the body.
Yeah, spreading the word.
Is that your specialty, do you think, in teaching?
It's my vocation.
Okay. We have time for a couple of others. Let's have about
two more
poems. Yeah.
All right. I'm going to end. This is the second last poem. It's called Knots, and it's a poem for my father and my son. Now, my son, I need a little preparation here. My son likes to climb, and one of the places I bring him to climb was called Cathedral Rock. This is an old church that was converted to a climbing center. So there he is climbing on his rocks, and he's climbing up toward these stained glass saints. So with my Catholic background, I thought, this is a poem for me. When I started writing the poem, my father came in. Because my father used to tie knots, and he taught me how to tie knots. So, okay, knots. I'm trying to remember the knots. Figure 8, bowline. Beckett Bend, my favorite. I'm trying to see again my father's brown hands in the mirror as they twined the Duke of Windsor knot until it was done, and I was off to the Paternoster and the hereafter. Down Olmsted Street, then Ontario, past Boney's Bar, where he had practiced the sheepshank and fisherman's bend, where he had made the long splice between two ends of frayed rope that night my mother high-heeled out. That's what I'm thinking as my son ascends the climbing wall of Cathedral Rock, stained glass saints still lifting their staffs and rods, their cupped worlds and glinting swords, while my son stretches carefully for whatever hold, hands powdered and taped, 12 years old, and still checking my figure 8 before he slid into the harness, checking my safety knot before he rose, not believing I had learned them all in my father's smoke, not hearing the names as I repeated them, refusing to follow the leader up and down, down, then up again until it was done and he was safely tied in and ready to ascend. Like my old man, no doubt, face down on that smooth, cool walnut bar where he had fallen asleep and finally ceased to exist, the knots coming undone with his every breath, until my father was nothing but miles of rope and a pair of knowing hands that are my hands, letting out and bringing in my boy at the other end of a rope that's knotted right, cinched, taut, and holding the weight.
Oh, Len. Let us have one poem now.
Okay.
To remember you by.
Thank you. This is The Silent Singer. In
title poem.
The title poem of the book, and when I was in grade school, I couldn't sing, still can't sing. And the nun told me to comb my hair, wear a shirt and tie, and to lip sync. To be seen, but not to be heard. The miracle of it all is that I did it, and people afterwards would come up and tell me how wonderful my singing was. So here's for the nuns, The Silent Singer. The girls sang better than the boys. Their voices reaching all the way to God. Sister Angelica insisted during those practice sessions. When I was told to mouth do re mi, but to go no higher. When I was told to stand in back and form a perfect O with my lips, or though no word was ever to come out. The silent singer in the third grade class, during the Christmas pageant and Easter week, the birth and death of Christ lip-synced but unsung. While my relatives, friends, and parents praise my baritone, how low my voice was, balancing those higher, more childlike tones, my father said. Adding depth, my mother said. Thank God they had my huskiness to bring all that tinniness to earth, my great aunt whispered. So I believed for many years in miracles myself, the words I had never sung, reaching their ears in the perfect pitch, the perfect tone, while the others stuttered in their all too human voices to praise the Lord.
The voice of Len Roberts. This program is made possible by the Humanities Council of Washington, D.C., and the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry, The Poet and the Poem, from the Library of Congress. It's produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production is by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. We wish to thank the Motion Picture, Broadcasting, and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. Our engineer is Bill Haley. I'm Grace Cavalieri.